Hello, you are tuning in to the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Youth Development podcast series. Today we're talking about why equity matters in youth development programs. My name is Carrie Robidoux and I'm a Youth Development Extension Educator. Joining me today is my colleague, Catherine Sharp. She's also an Extension Educator located in our urban offices. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Carrie. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Well, thank you for being here on a subject that I know is so near and dear to your heart. To get us started today, will you tell us a little bit about yourself, why you're working to achieve equity in youth development programs, and how this became a focus in your work?
Absolutely. Thank you. So I've been working with the Center for Youth Development for 8.5 years. But before that, I have over 15 years of experience in youth development programming. And it has been done really in the context of trying to build connections among people from diverse backgrounds and seeing all of the ways that that enhances all of us as whole human beings, that programs are more vibrant, that communities are stronger, and that young people thrive more holistically and completely when they learn to make connections across difference and when programs really are able to support them in an equitable way. I grew up in a community that was very homogenous with programs that were not designed to reach everyone, and I have seen firsthand the dramatic difference that it makes, and I want to make sure that all young people have access to that.
You know, that is just fantastic, and I think such important work that we all need to focus on. And I appreciate the amount of time that you have worked to achieve this. You recently participated in a North Star Youth Worker Fellowship. Can you share with us a little bit about what that experience was like for you? I also understand that you did some research in conjunction with that fellowship, and you looked at a research question that we'll tackle here in a couple minutes. But first of all, tell us what this fellowship was and what you learned from that experience.
Absolutely. So the North Star Youth Worker Fellowship is actually a partnership among several different organizations who bring together youth workers who are generally midway in their career. And the idea is to get people who are actively engaged in youth work, whether direct frontline practitioners or managers, and have them be engaging within research. And so developing research questions that have practical application that are drawn from our experience or are a critical issue or need in the field. So each cohort has a guiding question or a theme. And ours was about moving into the 21st century. What do we carry forward from the history of youth work and what do we need to create anew? And so my research question came out of that context. It's a cohort of a year-long cohort of people who work together to do our research as well as to support one another and to learn together.
What a great way to focus in on your work and a topic that is just so important. I'm going to go ahead and read your research question and I'm going to have you respond to that. Your research question was, as the demographic makeup of the United States undergoes a sea change of diversification, 4-H and other national historical legacy youth development organizations face a critical question. Here it is. What will it take to stay relevant in the 21st century? And like you said, looking at this particular topic, you offered three practical strategies. You actually offered a number of strategies, but we're going to focus on three of those today. First of all, how did you come up with that particular research question?
Well, as I mentioned before, you know, equity and diversity have been really strong guiding passions for me for a long time. And in my current work at the Center for Youth Development, I have been engaged with a lot of different colleagues on working on ways that we can both diversify our programs and try to promote and advance equity. And those are not the same things. Equity is not just having a more diverse program or just making sure that the door is open to all, but really making sure that everyone has what's needed to be able to get in the door and to make sure you're even inviting people to something they would want to come to. And so there are different questions. It goes beyond diversity or just equality. And so that's really what interests me because I think it's a lot easier to focus on diversity or equality, but to really achieve equity, takes more striving. It takes more focused effort. And I love that part of the process. And so as I looked at doing research for this fellowship, I knew I wanted to choose something that would have immediate applicability in my work and in our work and would hopefully advance the really important work that we have going on right now in the Center for Youth Development. And so as I talked with people and as I read, I realized that it really was about more than just looking at, oh, we have a more diverse youth population. What do we do to serve them? No, that's not really the fullness of the question. It's really, who do we need to become in the 21st century as an organization? How are we going to be shaped by these young people and their families and the communities and the new partner organizations who we have the opportunity to partner with now in this time of really wonderful, vibrant diversification? So that was how I settled on that question. Was it's a question that it helps us stretch a bit.
And you mentioned equity, equality, diversity. Can you just take us through quickly how you see those as three different components?
Sure. Well, I like to think of them as a dinner party. So if you are throwing an equality dinner party, you would just make sure that the invitation goes out and everyone is served the same thing. Everyone is greeted the same way at the door, and whoever comes is who comes because you've given equal opportunity. A diversity dinner party would be really trying to make sure that you had representation at your dinner party from different, you know, from the people in your community, right? And that they're represented. An equity dinner party, however, would focus not just on making sure you had representation, but finding out what kind of food do you even want? Do you eat dinner at this time? do you need a ride in order to be able to get there? It's really trying to focus not just on the intent of your actions, but the impact and the results, the outcomes. That's the difference between those words.
That is a great descriptor of that and leads us into this conversation that we're having here on the biases that exist in our organizational culture. Let's get to those three practical strategies that I had mentioned so that we can achieve that. The first one that you mentioned is about bringing staff into an organization right at the hiring process. When you're hiring someone, rethink the requirements for previous experience in the organization. How does a job description limit diversity?
Well, and this is something, and thank you so much for pulling out the issue around bias and implicit bias, because that is really one of the themes that I explored as a necessary thing to grapple with in working to become more equitable organizations. We have, especially those of us that have long histories, we have to acknowledge that the bias accumulates over time in an organization. It's not because any one person is bad. It's because we collectively come with unconscious judgments, and those accumulate and they become bad in many cases. But we need to figure out how to tackle this. And hiring is an absolutely fundamental, foundational place for any organization. And one thing that came out of my research was that as we look at hiring, we have expectations that often in and of themselves are limiting. For example, if you have an organization that is not particularly diverse or reflective of your community right now, if you institute a requirement in your hiring process or even a preference for experience within the organization, you are limiting yourself to a closed circuit loop of just the people who've already been part of the organization, which you already know are not representative. So in order to be able to truly bring in new people, what you need to do in looking at the job description is figure out what does having experience with this organization actually translate to? And what are the ways that someone could get those things if they don't have previous experience? So does it mean familiarity with our project system? Well, someone could get that by doing some research. Does it mean experience with a particular type of program that we offer? Well, they might have comparable experience in other organizations. So breaking it down so that it's not so that it doesn't require just that expectation. Or sometimes you have expectations for example, for driving. This is something that was brought up at a training I went to recently on access for people with disabilities. Does someone actually need to have a driver's license for this job? Or do they need access to reliable transportation? Could they be able to do this job if they were getting around in, you know, in transit that was provided, but they were not physically the one driving? Because requiring a driver's license definitely excludes some potential wonderful candidates.
Yeah, really opening. Yeah, I mean, opening our minds to what we really need for someone to fulfill this role, not the job description we've always had and how we picture how it's always been.
One of the fundamental pieces in addressing implicit bias is realizing that if we keep doing things the way that we have done them, the way that we have done them is only working for the people who are currently involved.
Well, and
it's only our hiring, and that's fundamentally where we have to start the changes.
Absolutely. And I think that leads us right into the second strategy that we'll talk about, making it everyone's job. You mentioned that every employee and volunteer should be explicitly told that they play a key role in advancing equity and diversity. Tell us more about that. How do we tackle that?
Absolutely. And I would also add on that they need to be held accountable and evaluated based on that. The reality of youth development is that a young person's experience with an organization is made by whoever they interact with. So in the case, for example, 4-H, where I work, where we both work, a young person's experience is in their 4-H club or their 4-H program experience. However they encounter that leader, those other young people, the volunteers, the parents, the interns, whoever it is that's leading it, that's going to be their perception of the organization. So we might have the most beautiful equal opportunity and non-discrimination statements, but if those aren't actually lived and embodied in the people who are working frontline with young people and their families, then that won't be people's experience of us. On the flip side as well, we also find that sometimes our frontline people are far ahead of even where our policies are at. And so someone may encounter the organization is super welcoming, super inviting, super inclusive, and then they run up against the reality of policies or things like that that might not be. But the reason that it needs to be everyone's work is because there's such a danger to scapegoating. If there's someone who's like, oh, that's his job, that's her job, that's their job. Mm-hmm. Similarly, sometimes people get intimidated. If people are relatively new to working with folks from different backgrounds or different experiences or different ability levels, different religions, they might feel a little intimidated and they might think, oh, someone kind of needs to be a specialist to be able to do this. Someone needs advanced training to be able to do this. And while it is helpful to have training, there are people who really specialize in doing this kind of work, but it really is human work. It's just work for each of us as human beings. And this is the best example of experiential learning I can think of. Like, we learn about relating to people from different backgrounds and accommodating and making resources available to them and meeting the needs that they may have by actually encountering them and building a meaningful relationship.
That's why
it needs to be everyone's work.
Well, and that you had brought up accountability, and I had thought about, well, sometimes we translate that as an organization as you mentioned, let's hire a specialist, somebody who knows about that. And then the rest of us know that that person will take care of whatever it is they need to take care of. So everybody feels like they're a part of this, that they belong. And what you're saying is that really we need to hold everyone accountable.
And I think those two things don't need to be mutually exclusive necessarily. I mean, there are definitely organizations that have a wonderful model of having someone who's a resource person or who can help sort of carry forward collective knowledge or help to streamline policies across the different parts of the organization so that as you learn how to become more equitable, it gets implemented in all the different programs. But it cannot stop there. It has to be something that comes all the way down to the grassroots level, all the way down to the frontline workers. And I will again point out that quite often in organizations, it goes in the other direction too. It's often frontline workers who are the ones who have really close relationships and they have a sense of what is needed in the community. And they may actually be the ones who are pushing for changes in the organization. And that is incredibly valuable as well.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, you're taking us right into number three, the third suggestion about decision-making power. Mm-hmm. Who holds the power to make decisions about policies and resource allocation? What are your suggestions for making this change in youth development programs?
Mm-hmm. So this is a critical question at all different levels of the organization. And in my research paper that I did, I sort of addressed three different approaches for this work. One is kind of the organizational level led by organizational positional leadership, right? The second one is looking from the grassroots, you know, that's coming from the front line up. And then the third one is looking at change that's created when employees get together in a cohort and work together as a group to create change kind of from the center out, as it were. But in all three of those levels of the organization, there always are groups that are making decisions. There are strategic planning processes, there are budget decisions that get made, hiring we already talked about, all kinds of decisions that happen. And here's a place where we can really work to counteract implicit bias by being intentional about including a more representative group of people in those decisions, and maybe even challenging our thoughts about who should be at the table. There are unconscious judgments that all of us hold and that often become sort of organizational unconscious judgments. Like, for example, when it comes to budgeting, oh, that's boring. Young people wouldn't be interested in that. Or, you know, really the people who would be best to do that are people with an accounting background. Well, they may bring gifts to the table, and maybe not all young people would want to be involved, but maybe it's also about how we are doing that budgeting process. Are we doing it in a welcoming way? Are we doing it in a way where an average person can come in and participate? Are we doing it in a way where someone for whom English might not be their first language would understand, you know, can we break down that really confusing spreadsheet and put it in a language that makes it accessible so that more people can have their voices and their values reflected in that process? And that not only brings more voices to the table and gives a greater sense of ownership, but it will challenge the implicit biases that occur in the individuals and in the organization as well.
Great. Well, Catherine, I want to thank you for sharing your research and thinking and practical experience with equity, with implicit bias, and just for sharing all of this information with us today. I know that you have thought much more about this beyond these three strategies. And so I want to encourage any of the listeners who are on today that if they would like to learn more about equity, implicit bias, diversity, all of these are on our youth development programs are on our website at www.extension.umn.edu/youth. And you can find other research training events, both online and in person, and you can check out the Minnesota 4-H program as well. Join us in the latest conversations in youth development by going to our Youth Development Insight blog. Catherine has blogged on this topic, and I know that she would enjoy conversing with you. You can leave a comment, and those of you who would like to read more, her research brief is also available on our website. Catherine, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Carrie. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to wrap up this podcast. This is Carrie Rabideau, again with Catherine Sharp from the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Youth Development. Please tune in again soon.